Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there again, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Tonight I want to talk about the various kind of conspiracies that surround Harold Wilson, the British Prime Minister, 64-70 and then 74-76. The most successful British Labour Prime Minister of the 20th century, electorally at the very least. And the relationship, or the very hostile relationship that existed between him and the security services. Now, the difficulty with this topic is that it is so mired in conspiracy theory, which, you know, aren't really theories at all. They're kind of just works of imagination. But there are certain aspects of what happened to Wilson which appear to be kind of demonstrably true. The fact that there was at least one military coup planned against him, an abortive one in 1967, which had Lord Louis Mountbatten's name attached to it. I think it's in season 3 of The Crown, in point of fact. Perhaps there was a number of other lesser plots featuring retired military officers about getting rid of Wilson. Who was this dangerous Bolshevik? Well, he was nothing of the sort. Harold Wilson was an establishment figure through and through. He was really from the centre ground of the Labour Party at the time. He believed in nuclear deterrence. He believed in maintaining British bases, and until unfortunately it became unaffordable. He believed in the royal family. He was, for his time, a kind of sceptical about both America and Europe, and thought that some kind of commonwealth, or some kind of retention of the last remaining colonies, might be possible. He viewed himself as a patriotic figure. Harold Wilson really posed as working class. He, during the kind of the brief kind of mood of egalitarianism in the late 50s and early 60s, which saw the kind of the rise in popularity of working class pop music in the guise of the Beatles and a number of other kind of working class figures, you know, culturally, people like Michael Caine and Terence Stamp. Wilson was able to pose with his pipe and say things like that he didn't eat smoked salmon, he ate tinned salmon and didn't have champagne, he liked a pint of beer. None of those things were true, in point of fact. Wilson liked the finer things in life and wasn't a pipe smoker, he was a cigar smoker. But he was very, very clever, very canny when it came to public relations and understood the way in which the wind was blowing in the 1960s, the early 60s, against Macmillan and the old Grouse-Moore Etonians and towards a new conception of Great Britain, one which really comes to a juddering halt in 1979. Margaret Thatcher, in some ways, tries to kind of appropriate a sort of lower middle class egalitarianism. She makes it quite abundantly clear that she's not one of the insiders, not one of the old boys network that have held the country back. And she had the kind of the Grouse-Moore elitists in her sight, every much as she did the trade unions, except she was about to drag the country in a radical right-wing direction. So sometimes it's difficult to fathom what the obsession that the security services, the army, the newspaper magnates, who were more than happy to undermine him, and what their kind of their principal objection to Wilson was. And I think it's this. I think it's not that Wilson was necessarily taking the country radically towards the left. I mean, his great progressive achievement between 64 and 70 was the establishment of the Open University, which, again, is hardly the kind of, you know, collectivising the farms, is it really? It's his principal issue was that he presided over a period of relative economic decline. There was a boom period in the mid-60s, and by 67, 68, inflation is starting to gradually creep up. Union unrest is growing. And by 1970, when he loses, much to his surprise, to Ted Heath, the country's in some significant trouble. And I think many of Britain's elites, who never really view the Labour Party as a legitimate government whenever it kind of comes to power, their view was that, you know, the moment you get a successful Labour leader in charge, the country goes to hell in a handcart. Well, the truth, of course, is that the huge economic problems had been inherited from Macmillan, an overheated economy, a dreadful deficit and balance of payments problems and all sorts of things. So far so that it was Reginald Maudling who first, Macmillan's treasurer, Hume's treasurer, because it was Alec Douglas Hume he beat, not Macmillan. It was Hume's treasurer who left him a note saying there's nothing left, basically. There's nothing left in the kitty. Okay, so we're going to dive now into looking at the relationship between Wilson and the secret state. I'm kind of reticent to go down too many rabbit holes. These are only 25-minute podcasts, and to talk about whether the MI6 was really spying on Harold Wilson or they forced him to resign—that's a story for another time. Okay, so this is from former Tory MP Stephen Dorrell and co-writer Robert Ramsey's book *Smear: Wilson and the Secret State*. And they write, Wilson was not an intelligence insider. He had no direct experience of the world of spooks. His closest contact with the intelligence agencies had been in the 40s during the war, when as the president of the Board of Trade, he received security briefings. When he finally did enter the secret corridors of Whitehall, meeting the chief of MI6, Dick White, Wilson put on the vestments of secrecy like a true patriot. So Wilson was more than happy to embrace the kind of the traditions and the mores of the establishment that he had kind of that he had entered. In July 1963, a security row blew up when it was announced that Kim Philby, formerly attached to the Foreign Office, which is a euphemism for MI6 agent, had defected to the Soviet Union. Wilson requested an appointment with the then Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, and in one of those arcane rituals common to the British state, a meeting was arranged behind the Speaker's chair on the Privy Council terms. This meant that the contents of the conversation could not be passed on to Wilson's colleagues. Macmillan reveals in his diaries that he asked Dick White to give Wilson the whole facts. While what he was public knowledge could not have been justified, the manifest failure of the Secret Service to keep Philby under control, one simple fact I was given made sense of the story. I was satisfied and felt it my duty to say so in the House without giving reason and ask my right honourable friends to let it go. This is from Wilson's memoirs. To ensure completely that the opposition leader shared his views on the national interest, Macmillan convened a second meeting on the 11th of May. I had an hour with Harold Wilson, Macmillan wrote in his diary, and tried to explain to him how the so-called security services really worked. It seemed to be right to do so, and he took it quite well. One Labour backbencher, Niall McDermott, knew all about Philby and his true importance as a defector. McDermott had served in MI5 and met MI6 as then head of Section 5 during the war. When McDermott began to raise the matter in the House of Commons, Wilson cut him off by suggesting that there were issues which cannot be discussed across the floor of the House. Next day, Macmillan recorded how grateful he was for Wilson's high sense of responsibility. So again, this is the interesting part about all this. Wilson was very, very good at closing ranks. He saw his responsibility to the security state, the what conspiracy theorists would call this thing called the deep state, whatever that might mean, as being far more important than any party political point, and far more important than the kind of the wider ramifications for British security and indeed British democracy. And some might think Wilson to be naive, but also, this is in keeping in the main with how Labour leaders function. Labour leaders, by and large, adopt similar stances. If one looks at Ramsay MacDonald was co-opted very, very quickly into the functioning of the state, so much so that Treasury officials allied with gentlemen from the City of London would visit him and explain to him really how the economies ought to work and disabuse him of any perhaps slightly Bolshevist notions he had. Again, Ramsay MacDonald had none. Later on, when we look at Attlee is a wartime Labour leader and Deputy Prime Minister, and a kind of a thorough member of Britain's cabinet and Britain's Churchill's wartime cabinet, and after the Second World War is chief in helping Britain acquire the atomic bomb and defending Britain's overseas assets. Clement Attlee was not a radical decoloniser, no matter what is suggested. He decolonised India and Palestine when there was so much prospective pain involved for for Great Britain and the likelihood of huge bloodshed and conflict in order to hang on to these colonies, that there seemed to be no other point. There were all sorts of interesting and radical plans to reshape and remodel Malaya, to develop Malaya, and to use the wealth of Malaya, which was considerable, in order to support Britain's welfare state. So the idea that Labour leaders are by their nature a bunch of dangerous radicals is for the birds, really. I mean, the only two that one can point a finger at and suggest that they were likely to say things which were completely and utterly unpalatable were Michael Foot and Jeremy Corbyn. And these were Labour leaders who were treated to the full force of kind of establishment rage for having the temerity to be elected to office. Wilson, though, seems to have been this kind of magnet for the security state. However, Dorrell and Ramsay write, the slim knowledge which Wilson did possess regarding the intelligence world was filtered through George Wigg. Colonel Wigg had served in the army for 18 years and had been the parliamentary private secretary to a Labour Minister of War. As a backbencher, Wigg was known as the army's watchdog in the House of Commons. Although he had never actually been in the intelligence game, and was really an amateur, he did possess a high degree of experience in the defence field and held strong views on security and patriotism. The Philby affair reinforced Wigg's contempt for MI6, views which were encouraged by Henry Kirby, a maverick Tory MP, who had served in MI6 during the war. Kirby believed that the Secret Service had been deeply penetrated by the KGB, turned out to be correct. MI6 was doing nothing about this, he suggested, because the service was run by unfrocked dons, misfits, oddities, queers and drunks, and the Foreign Office boys who were rogering their own rectums. Apologies for that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Kirby trusted Wigg's patriotism more than he did that of his own party, and the gossip he gave him encouraged Wigg towards a sympathetic view of MI5. What Wigg did not know was that Kirby was being run as an agent within the House of Commons by MI5. A former defence correspondent and backbench colleague of Wigg, Ray Fletcher, says that Wigg saw the difference between MI5 and MI6 as a class thing. Wigg told him some of MI5's boys belonged to the secondary schools, but the MI6 lot were all Oxbridge types. Fletcher believes that while Wigg was not perfect, he did an honest job, but was later the victim of MI6 smears. This is an example of the recruiting battle between MI5 and MI6, one of the themes dominating British intelligence. So, Parliament and parliamentarians often exist within the reach of the intelligence services. These days, there are the intelligence services have nowhere near the kind of the ability to influence and sway backbench MPs, and successive kind of waves of essentially professionalisation of the intelligence services have fundamentally changed them, and made the kind of the picture painted here really a thing of the dim and the distant Cold War past. And the context of the Cold War kind of colours all other things. But it was clear that the way in which Wilson was being fed information and the way that Wilson was essentially being handled before he became Prime Minister was with a view to him possibly being the chief figure in the British security state. And so he was being guided in certain ways towards essentially the interests of the security services and the interests of different branches of the security services. Wilson himself, as it says at the start of the book, Wilson was no kind of insider. And there have been a few prime ministers. I mean, Churchill is obviously a glaring example, but also Anthony Eden and Harold Macmillan, who were very familiar with the security services, very familiar with the intelligence services, and understood their working and were accepted into their world. A lot of this is to do with social class. A lot of this is to do with elitism and snobbery, and the fact that connections and old school ties, which still count for an enormous amount in Great Britain now, counted for even more in the 1960s and 70s. When Filby was exposed, or when it was strongly intimated that Filby might be a Soviet agent, it was Macmillan, as Foreign Secretary, that made a statement in his clearing his name, and it was only upon his defection that the scandal broke loose. This in 1963, when he defected and was referred to as a Foreign Office official, it took a further 5 years. And it was the Sunday Times and the brilliant journalist Philip Knightley, who I was fortunate to correspond with before he passed away, who finally broke the story that Kim Philby was not in fact a junior Foreign Office clerk, but was head of counterintelligence at MI6. Something that, as you can imagine, puts an entirely different light on the story. The establishment was utterly mortified by Philby's betrayal, but closed ranks as establishments the world over tend to do. And the fact that so many of those who were left looking foolish were connected by allegiance, by friendship, by school background and university, pointed out to many that the security services and the establishment themselves were kind of grossly incompetent. One of the things that's made abundantly clear by Philip Knightley in his book Philby, KGB Master Spy, which is an amazing account of Philby's life and probably one of the most accurate ever penned in a kind of a field where a lot of nonsense is written about the guy. One of the things he points out is that there was a widespread belief that whoever the mole was, it couldn't be Philby because he was a good guy and he'd been to the right school. Philby was eventually rumbled, not by anyone from Great Britain initially, but by an FBI officer who, as Philby was the MI6 guy in Washington. And so many joint MI6 and CIA operations behind the Iron Curtain kept failing. The FBI looked at the people who were involved and just said, this can't be pure chance. It was straight police work and looking at the evidence dispassionately that first began to point to the fact that Philby was compromised or working as a double agent and betraying agents who are dropped to places like Bulgaria. So it's interesting to note that the demise of Philby came from sources external to Great Britain and certainly external to Britain's kind of elite class system. Coming back to Wilson, Wilson's decision to leave office after his return to power in 1974 was based in part the fact that he wasn't well. He had grown. He was old. He was a shadow of the ebullient figure that had come to power 10 years earlier, and was exhausted by struggles with the unions. He eventually, many years later, died of Alzheimer's, and he may have been kind of in early onset. But he was obsessed with the fact that he was being bugged, his officers were being bugged. And he believed, he was increasingly paranoid and suspicious. He eventually became very paranoid of his cabinet colleagues thinking they were trying to take his job. But the evidence to suggest that he was being bugged is not inconsiderable. Now, like I said, that's a kind of a topic for the future, and I do hope to cover it. But what I think that we can learn from this podcast is that, you know, Wilson was this kind of fish out of water in a world of Etonian ties, hoping to really be a faithful servant of Britain's establishment and a kind of a good, loyal figure of the British state. But he was turned on nonetheless. In the early 80s, Chris Mullins, a Labour MP, wrote a quite famous novel called A Very British Coup. It was made into a TV series about a left-wing British MP becoming Prime Minister and a coup by the security state against him. This wouldn't happen now. We've already seen what actually does happen when Labour elects a genuinely left-wing leader. The sharp teeth of the British state don't have to do anything at all, because their best guys within the Labour Party are the ones that take care of the problem. The right of the Labour Party that essentially removed Jeremy Corbyn, for whatever his shortcomings or faults or ups and downs, removed him from power and engineered Labour's loss in to the 2017 and 19 elections, are the ones who now safeguard Britain from the prospect of progressive or radical change. Thanks very much for listening. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do swing by our website, www.explaininghistory.org. And there's always a bit of interesting new content on there. Check us out in the Explaining History podcast Facebook group. Always some interesting articles going up there. And I'll look forward to speaking to you all soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.